Hello, and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today are Semantic Threat Researchers Bridget O'Gorman and Stephen Doherty. In this week's podcast, we'll be discussing our new research about cyber attacks against financial institutions in West Africa, how 1 in 5 free VPN apps for Android devices may be actually malicious, how a hitman's fitness tracker helped police time to a murder, and the latest on election-related cyber attacks in the United States. But first, anyone playing the new massive multiplayer online game Atlas last week may have gotten something of a surprise when strange objects suddenly began appearing in the game. Atlas is a pirate-themed game, so think lots of sailing ships and cutlasses and wooden legs, but suddenly last week, World War II-era planes and tanks suddenly began appearing in the game, killing off players and damaging their ships. So what was going on? It seems that somebody got their hands on the credentials for a game admin's Steam account, logged in, and began spawning a host of tanks and planes. As a result, Atlas's maker, Grapeshot Games, was forced to roll back the game server by 5 hours to clean up the entire mess. There's a few funny videos on Twitch of players' startled reactions that are worth checking out. If a plague of tanks and planes wasn't bad enough, the game experienced further mishaps because just a few days later, players experienced a plague of whales. What led to it wasn't a pilfered admin credential. Instead, somebody discovered a vulnerability in the game which allowed them to spawn an unlimited number of any item that they wanted. Word got around about the flaw, and lots of people started spawning whales. Not just in the water, though, but also on land and flying through the air. When people started getting bored of whales, they moved on to dragons, with predictable results. And when they got bored of that, they resorted to spamming the in-game messaging service with the by now cliched subscribe to PewDiePie message. There's no indication that this incident had anything to do with the earlier PewDiePie-related attacks. At this stage, it seems that it's just a thing anyone now who has access to an easy means of spamming devices does. So, Grapeshot was forced to once again roll back the Atlas servers and ban multiple users. Needless to say, the vulnerability is now being patched. Grapeshot will no doubt be hoping that from now on it'll all be plain sailing, to pardon the pun, for Atlas. So, moving on to more serious matters. Last week, Semantic published a new piece of research about a series of attacks against financial targets in West Africa. And here to tell us more is Stephen Doherty, who was the principal researcher on the project. So, Stephen, what's been going on in West Africa?
So, as you said, Semantic recently discovered several interesting attacks targeting financial institutions in West African countries. The first evidence of these attacks was observed in an organization in the Ivory Coast. So that's kind of where our investigation began. And when we kind of spidered out, it quickly became apparent that other organizations in the financial industry were also targeted. So countries in West Africa include Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ghana, and Equatorial Guinea. So they were also impacted by these attacks. The attacks themselves have been underway since, we believe, at least mid-2017, so they've been going on for well over a year. And the attackers in these situations are using commodity malware during their operations to remotely control the networks. Some of the malware observed in these attacks are pretty well-known tools. For example, Imminent Monitor is a tool which you can purchase for as little as $25. Nanocore Rat is another one. Cobalt Strike and Remote Manipulator Systems. So it seems to be a common theme in these attacks that they're using commodity malware. They're not developing their own malware and going after the networks. They just buy readily available tools. And I guess they're interesting in itself is that in a lot of these sophisticated attacks that we've seen to date, they would be well-developed cyber criminal operations who do have access to custom developed tools, but now we're seeing I guess maybe the bar is a little bit lower here. They're just buying the tools and then using them. They're getting into these networks by email. The lures are pretty simple. They just pretend to imitate legitimate correspondence from a financial institution within the region, so the end user might think that they're having some legitimate conversation with another bank, where in fact it's one of the bad guys trying to get one of these tools deployed onto their network. And then I guess we kept digging to see what kind of things they were doing on the network, where they were going, so we could see they were trying to discover additional assets on the network, maybe machines of more interest to the attackers, so they might get in on one employee's machine, but then further discover additional machines on the network, steal credentials. So we've seen the evidence of Mimikatz tool, which is quite a popular tool used to steal credentials, and then other tools for additional remote control. So we've seen them deploy Ultra VNC, we've seen them open up RDP access, so it gives the attackers more avenues to get onto the network. And we believe that getting onto the network for the purposes of financial gain, really, like when attackers go after banks, they're generally interested in the money that they can make. So we believe they go and they find the machines of interest, those that may be able to facilitate financial transactions. So maybe machines connected to ATMs, or machines of employees who are able to facilitate financial transactions. And then the typical modus operandi then is just to monitor the employees' behaviors, how they do their job, and then you basically learn how to be a bank employee, and then create a fraudulent transfer to an account under the attacker's control, and hopefully do this without the bank noticing.
Yeah, so I guess every bank has a different way of doing things, and they just they sit on the network long enough to see how it's done in that particular bank and then try and perform a few fraudulent transactions themselves.
Exactly, yeah. I think a lot of banks have different systems in place, and the only way for the attackers to really understand how the bank works internally is to sit there and look and understand how the bank works and how the employees do their jobs.
Yeah, okay. So they get on the network, find machines of interest, and then there'll be a kind of reconnaissance period where they're gathering data and gathering credentials before they could maybe perform fraud, if that's what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. So they're in there for the long haul.
Yeah. And how were these attacks discovered?
For these attacks, it was discovered by Symantec's targeted attack analytics capability. So in this situation, actually one financial organization was the victim of four different attacks. And these were all captured by targeted attack analytics, also known as TAA. In a nutshell, it applies artificial intelligence across all the data that we collect, and it's able to identify targeted attacks, basically. It's kind of like a virtual analyst, so they apply the methodology that, let's say, I would apply during my day-to-day discovery of attacks, but they do this at scale, and they take the input from the research that we do and feed it back into the platform, I guess, and then they're able to identify newer and different methods of attacks that are going on. And I guess what we did in like a lot of incidents are created by targeted attack analytics, like thousands of events are being reported, so it's quite a significant number of interesting events that it's able to capture. So we kind of hone in on the ones that might be more significant. So in this case, we said, okay, there's a number of incidents going on in one particular organization in the financial industry. Maybe it's worth a bit of a deeper dive to see what else is going on.
Okay, so you saw four different kinds of attacks initially against one target, and then you found more examples against other targets. Does this mean that it's four different groups trying to do the same thing, or is it the same group doing using different tools, or what is it?
Yeah, so I guess the answer is we don't know 100%.
Yeah.
I think it's quite likely it's probably three to four actors. I think the main reason for this is they're using distinctive tool sets for remote access. So we called out the four different remote access tools that they use. But then we also see there's kind of a variation in what they do post-compromise. Even the tools that they use after the fact, once they get onto the network, they're slightly different. But this could also mean that we're just looking at different operators who work on the same team. So different operators might have a preference for particular tools, and they're used to them. That's how they kind of carry out their cyber criminal activities. But at the end of the day, they might be working for one particular higher level organization. But I guess we could say there's more than likely three to four actors responsible for this activity.
Okay. So one of the interesting things you flagged there was the fact that all of the attacks involve commodity malware, stuff you can buy yourself on the underground. There's no custom developed tools there. Is this because it makes the attacks more difficult to trace to any particular group, or does it mean that the attackers themselves don't really have the expertise to write their own malware?
I think it's probably the fact that they may not have the expertise or just the time to develop their own sets. There may be small teams, so they're kind of outsourcing part of it. So instead of spending time developing a tool, you can just buy one. I think the Imminent Monitor, as I mentioned earlier, was available for $25. The others are readily available as well. They're fit for purpose. They provide them with remote access capabilities. So it's like by design, it's a good tool for them to use. It gives them remote access. They're able to navigate through networks, deploy additional tools, steal files. So I would say it's probably more the case if it's of a relatively small team who don't have in-house development that we do see in more well-developed cyber criminal enterprises. They do have the capabilities to develop their own malware and readily update it. In this case, I think they just rely on a third party and are happy to pay the $25. It's relatively cheap.
Yeah, it's pretty reasonable free for the kind of activity they're engaging in. Yeah. Okay, thanks, Steve. Let's move on to the next item, because people with concerns about maintaining their privacy on cell phones might be worried when they hear about what Bridget has to say.
Yeah, so specifically Android users, as we looked at some research that was released in the last week, which examined the performance of the 150 most popular free VPN apps in the official Google Play store. And it found that one in five of them, just over 18% to be exact, was a potential source of malware. Now, VPNs, for those who don't know much about them, are virtual private networks that encrypt your internet traffic. So if you use a VPN, the website you're visiting won't know your true IP address, and you know your internet activity shouldn't be able to be tracked, things like that. So it's an extra layer of privacy for people generally. Now, people use VPNs for all manner of reasons, from kind of innocuous reasons such as to geo-spoof their location, so you can maybe watch, you know, US Netflix even if you're in Europe, or for more serious reasons as well, such as dissidents or activists might use them if they want to hide their kind of internet browsing activity from authoritarian governments, things like that. So I have a lot of concern for people like that who are using this for privacy reasons, especially, is that in this research, it was also found that a quarter of these free VPNs also suffer from privacy breaking bugs, such as, for example, DNS leaks. So this kind of leak could expose a user's browsing history to their internet service provider, as well as to any other third party DNS service operators that it may use, which obviously then defeats the purpose of actually using a VPN in the first place.
Yeah, so right there, there's two pretty serious findings. Did the research uncover anything else interesting?
Yeah, so they're definitely the most serious findings, I would say, from this research. But concerningly, this research also found that 85% of all the VPNs it tested, so I mean, that's obviously a huge percentage, sought excessive permissions or functions that would have the potential to expose users to privacy abuses. So these excessive permissions included things like a quarter of the apps sought access to a user's location, almost 40% sought access to a device's status information, and more than half sought to install code that would allow them to discover a user's last known location. In smaller numbers then as well, a small number of the apps also sought permission to access things like the phone's camera and microphone, as well as permission to send text messages on the phone. So that's pretty serious. And research conducted by ourselves here in Symantec a few months ago did find that 89% of Android apps that we looked at sought risky permissions. But obviously when it's a VPN app that's seeking these permissions, that's even more concerning, given that users have obviously expectation of privacy when they use their apps. That's why they're using them. And I suppose research like this does underline that, you know, nothing's really free. Like, free apps are very rarely actually free, in that you often pay by the access that the people behind these apps can gain to, you know, data or your device or things like that.
Indeed. And that wasn't the only mobile app story that we thought was worth mentioning this week, was it?
No, yeah. Some other research out this week that was kind of interesting found an interesting feature in some malicious apps that were downloaded from the Google Play Store as well. And in order to avoid detection, these apps monitored the motion sensor input of an infected device before they downloaded a malicious payload, which in the case of these apps that were examined was a banking Trojan. So they do this in an effort to ensure that they don't download the malicious payload onto an emulator that is potentially being used by security researchers to detect malicious apps. So motion sensors on phones that are being used by real people will obviously be activated as people use them and move around, whereas they're less likely to be activated, obviously, on emulators that would be used by researchers. So it is really quite clever on the part of the cyber criminals. So two apps on the Google Play Store called Battery Saver Mobi and a Currency Converter app, they were both recently spotted using this technique, and then subsequently downloading a banking Trojan if they determined that they weren't on a, you know, a fake phone, I suppose. Now that's been discovered, they have now been removed from the Play Store, so they're gone now. But that could be a kind of a potential new technique that could be adopted that we should keep an eye on, probably.
It's pretty clever, all right.
So moving on to our next item now. It was also reported last week that a hitman in the UK has been jailed for murder after his fitness tracker helped police to tie him to the crime scene. So do you want to tell us what happened here, Dick?
Yeah, the man in question, his name is Mark Fellows, and he was last week convicted of the murder of two men by Liverpool Crown Court in England. So Fellows, who's known by the nickname Iceman, was described in the press as being a fitness fanatic, a sous chef and a family man, which is quite an incongruous combination, to say the least, about a convicted murderer nicknamed Iceman. So Fellows was convicted for the murder of two men, Paul Massey in July 2015 and Paul Kinsella in May of last year. And police broke the case after Kinsella's murder. He'd been shot by a masked gunman on a bicycle wearing a high-vis vest. Police then trawled CCTV footage from the area, and the combination of the bicycle and the vest proved quite easy to track, and it eventually led them back to Fellows' home.
Right, so some good old-fashioned police work there, but where does the fitness tracker come in?
Well, police decided to search Fellows' home, and one of the things they found there was his Garmin Forerunner watch. So they searched through the watch's GPS data and discovered evidence of his involvement in the first murder, that is of Paul Massey. So according to the watch, he'd been carrying out reconnaissance around Massey's home shortly before the shooting. That then prompted them to check cell phone data and CCTV and some vehicle license plate reader data, and they found that his car had been driving past Massey's house at least twice a day in the week prior to the killing. So I was almost going to say that the moral of the story is going to be, if you're going to shoot someone, don't bring your fitness tracker. But obviously it should be simply just don't shoot someone.
Yeah, I think that's probably our official line on it.
Yeah, right. And with that pearl of wisdom, we'll go on to talk about the next item, because there was some developments this week on the alleged Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah, so the DNC came out in the last week and it revealed that Russian hackers had tried to break into its servers in November of last year, November 2018, just shortly after the conclusion of the 2018 midterm elections. So the DNC says that on November 14th, last dozens of DNC email addresses were targeted in a spear phishing campaign. Although it did add that it has had no indication that any of the spear phishing attempts were successful. It further said that the content and the timestamps of the emails were consistent with a known spear phishing campaign that has been tied to APT29, aka Cozy Bear. So this wider spear phishing campaign was written about at the time last year, with the emails crafted to look like they came from a Department of State official. And those emails targeted a number of sectors, including think tanks, law enforcement, business information services, as well as government. Although it was not known at the time until they revealed it themselves that the DNC was one of those targets. Now, Cozy Bear, of course, is one of the hacking groups, along with Fancy Bear, that is accused of hacking the DNC prior to the US presidential election in 2016 as well. So obviously this is something we'll continue to be keeping an eye on going forward.
And that's not the only Russia-related story in the news this week.
No, actually, there's been a couple of stories related to Russia in the news in the last week or so. So early last week, Facebook announced that it would be removing multiple pages, groups and accounts that engaged in what it described as coordinated inauthentic behaviour on Facebook and Instagram, with the social media giant saying that the operations behind this inauthentic behaviour and these inauthentic accounts originated in Russia. So Facebook said that the inauthentic activity was coordinated and that those behind it used fake accounts to misrepresent themselves, which was why they had been removed. So in one campaign, these accounts operated in the Baltics in Central Asia, as well as in Central and Eastern European countries. And they masqueraded as kind of general interest pages on things about things like the weather or travel or sport. But they then posted about topics, you know, containing things like anti-NATO sentiment or about protest movements in various countries. So in total, in that campaign, 289 pages and 75 Facebook accounts were removed following Facebook's investigation there. And then a separate campaign that Facebook said also originated in Russia apparently specifically targeted users in Ukraine on both Facebook and Instagram, which obviously is owned by Facebook. And in that case, 26 pages, 77 Facebook accounts, 4 groups and 41 Instagram accounts were removed by Facebook in relation to that campaign. And then in obviously a totally separate and completely unrelated development, some days after news of those accounts being scrubbed by Facebook broke, Russia announced that it was opening administrative proceedings against Twitter and Facebook for failing to explain how they plan to comply with local data laws. So Russian officials said that Twitter and Facebook had not explained how and when they would comply with legislation that requires all servers used to store Russians' personal data to be located in Russia, which is a new and quite controversial ruling that was brought in over the last couple of years. And Reuters has reported that officials said the companies have 1 month to provide information or action will be taken against them. So we'll have to keep an eye on developments there as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's about all we have time for this week. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, including that research on the African financial attacks we discussed earlier, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week when we'll be once again looking at what's going on in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.